studies and the ideas in the book are saying your body is your friend. Well, and it's really wanting to help you and got things to teach you.
Steve, anxiety not helped by the Five Life Stress Med playing under you, trying to keep us all calm. Thanks for being with us.
Lovely to talk. Thank you.
Steve Biddulph, author of Wild Creature Mind.
Fascinating.
The voice of the UK.
This is Five Live Drive.
And at 6 o'clock, let's get your BBC News headlines. And so Keir Starmer has said things will be tough for the short term, but will be worth it in the long term during his speech to the Labour Party conference in Liverpool. The Prime Minister has said he'll lead a great reforming government that'll improve the economy, tackle welfare fraud and reduce energy bills. He's been trying to counteract recent negative messaging about the economy and criticism for scrapping winter fuel payments for millions of pensioners. Here's the BBC's Deputy Political Editor, Vicky Young.
I think there was, you know, a bit of a recalibration, certainly in the tone. We've had a lot of people here, you know, worried about the doom and gloom, obviously warning that it's going to be very difficult. But, you know, there was a bit more hope, really. It was a sort of state of the nation, talking about national renewal, but saying it's going to take a very long time and that there will be some tough decisions in the short term.
President Biden has told the UN General Assembly that a diplomatic solution to the conflict in the Middle East is still possible, despite intense strikes between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon. Israel says it has killed one of the militant group's senior commanders with an airstrike on the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Civilians have been fleeing the attacks, with Israel saying it warned civilians to leave areas close to Hezbollah sites. UNICEF says people there are in need of basic necessities. Edouard Begbe is its Lebanese representative.
UNICEF is distributing here blankets, hygiene kits, mattresses and providing some water. What struck me is naturally all the stories of the mothers and the children and the way they had to flee their houses. Most of them have left in a few minutes. Some of them have seen their house being destroyed.
Two men aged 52 and 18 have been arrested on suspicion of murder after a 15-year-old boy was stabbed to death in southeast London. The Metropolitan Police have named the boy who died in Woolwich as Dejuan Campbell. The number of people in Scotland living in temporary accommodation because of homelessness has reached a record high. As of March this year, more than 16,000 people were in the system, according to Scottish Government figures released today. That's a 9% increase on the year before. And 23 flood warnings remain in place in Northamptonshire, Buckinghamshire and surrounding counties after some areas saw more than a month's worth of rain in a matter of hours over yesterday and Sunday. A yellow weather warning for rain on Thursday is also in place across parts of northern England and the North Midlands. And I've just glanced at the screen at the Clickit. No weather warnings there. The sun is shining. A beautiful sunset there, David.
Looking very nice. Ellie Aldroyd can tell us more in a moment, I'm sure, but we'll get the latest from England's third one-day international against Australia in Durham, where Ellie Aldroyd, England have responded well to losing their two openers.
Yes, they have, and Harry Brook has just brought up the 100 with a 6. It is a lovely evening here, actually. Long shadows and bright sunshine illuminating Lumley Castle over to the right. But England have done a really, really good job of rebuilding after they lost Salt and Duckett in the first Mitchell Starc over, and Australia hampered as well by the fact that they can't call on the services of Adam Zampa, who is not well and misses this game. That was a majestic shot by Harry Brook. He is on 47. Jack's also on 47, and England 105 for 2 in the 20th over.
Commentary continues on Five Sports Extra. Nottingham Forest captain Morgan Gibbs-White, his manager Nuno Santo and Brighton boss Fabian Hürtzler have all been charged by the FA following their red cards in Sunday's Premier League match at the Amex. And Australia's Neil Robertson is through to the third round of the British Open snooker after he beat Scotland's Chris Totten 4-1.
The latest travel. The M60's looking busy tonight. There's an accident. It's at Worsley at Junction 13 on the clockwise side. One lane closed, but busy on most routes in Manchester. A lot of East Manchester traffic heading for the Etihad. That seems to be the cause as well. So a lot of traffic out there. The M1 in West Yorkshire at Junction 40 at Ossett. There's an accident. It's in one of the lanes. And we've also had another accident come through for the M60. It's near Stockport now at Junction 1. So it looks as though no lanes are closed, but there are queues from 1 to 25 at Brinnington, anti-clockwise on the M60. M60. M23 heading south, junction 8 near the M25. There was a broken down van in one lane. The M25 anti-clockwise queue still there near junction 12 near the M3. That's repairs going on with one lane closed. Queue's about to 13 at Staines. Back up to the M8 in Glasgow. Two lanes are still closed near the M80 at Provan. Westbound there, repairs going on. The M3 at Winchester South 11, and that's where the repairs continue there. So you've got one lane closed. Heavy traffic still showing up. Tower Bridge in London is still closed in both directions because of an accident, and the A55 the latest, so it was an accident. It's closed westbound between junction 34 at Eulow and 33B at Mould, with the queues backing up to junction 35 at Dobbs Hill. And on the trains, this has come through as well. A bit of a problem now between Reading and Didcot Parkway, affecting all services travelling through there. That's Cross Country and Great Western Railway. Horner Merchant, 5 Live Travel.
On BBC iPlayer.
I want to take you on tour. I want to take you to India.
Wow! Buzzing mate.
I've never been anywhere like it.
Freddie Flintoff's Field of Dreams on tour.
We're representing England, but we're representing something far bigger than that. We're representing Preston.
Watch on BBC iPlayer.
The voice of the UK.
This is 5 Live Drive.
Five past six, Holly Hamilton, Tony Livesey with you on Drive. We're going to talk Hillsborough later in this hour of the programme, and we'll be at the UN General Assembly as well. But for now, let's talk Middle East. Israel says it's killed a senior Hezbollah commander in an airstrike in Beirut. A spokesman for the IDF says Ibrahim Mohamed Kebesi was the commander of the militant group's missile and rocket force responsible for launching missiles into Israel. The Lebanese health ministry says 6 people died and 15 others were injured in the attack, which was on a residential building in a Hezbollah stronghold. And now the number of people that have been killed, they say, since the latest wave of attacks is 564. So bearing in mind all current events, it's often good to give ourselves context as well, because there's a lot of assumed knowledge, isn't there, when we talk about events like this. And we want to get back to basics if we can for a moment. Frank Gardner, the BBC security correspondent, joins us on the programme. Hello, Frank.
Hi there, good evening.
Thanks for being with us. Frank, we will get on to current events eventually, but just can you, for all our benefit, just can you spell out the relationship, the three-way relationship between Lebanon, Hezbollah and Israel, the historical context?
Sure. Well, they're neighbours. Lebanon and Israel are sovereign states in their own right. Lebanon is this absolutely stunningly beautiful mountain, coastal, Mediterranean country, pretty small, used to be a French protectorate, but it had a massive civil war of its own from 75 to till 1990, and it's never really been a particularly easy place since then. It's a very divided place between Sunnis, Shias, Christians, Druze, and others. And it was occupied by the Syrians and by the Israeli army. Israel has had to contend for a very long time, for decades, with Hezbollah, which is started out as an Iranian proxy militia. So if you remember, Iran had this big Islamic revolution in 79. They decided to export that to Lebanon, and they created this proxy army called Hezbollah. It's an Arabic word. It means party of God. And Hezbollah today is the most powerful non-state military force in the world. It's also a political party, and they've got MPs in parliament. It's very odd. So they are a prescribed terrorist organization by the UK and the US and other countries, Western countries, and yet they are a political force, a legitimate political force in Lebanese politics. But they, so if you remember October the 7th, there was this horrendous attack on Israel, followed by the horrendous conflict in Gaza that has killed over 40,000 Palestinians, most of them civilians, most of them women and children, but a large number of Hamas fighters as well. And the very day after that, Hezbollah started firing rockets into northern Israel in solidarity with its Palestinian brethren, as it put it, in Gaza. And that has been the kind of simmering low-level conflict in the north for the past 11 months. Israel's decided that it's fed up with that, that it's not going to put up with 60,000 of its residents not being able to return home. So it's upped the ante and has decided, well, it started out with that weird exploding pager attack, followed by these airstrikes and targeted assassinations. So now there's a lot of talk about, are Israel and Hezbollah on the brink? Lebanon, the country that hosts Hezbollah, is very very nervous about this. Not everybody supports Hezbollah, but pretty much everybody is angry with Israel, saying, why on earth do we deserve this? Why are our homes and villages being reduced to rubble? This is not our fight. We didn't deserve this, because there's a lot of civilian casualties. I mean, you heard it there, over 550 people killed. This is the biggest death toll since 1990 in Lebanon in a single day.
Frank, at the time you were writing articles on that page a day, and then the day after with the walkie-talks and all that kind of thing, saying ordinarily now this will be the precursor to an attack, and then that any ground offensive didn't happen. So what do you make of the subsequent escalation? And you've talked about Iran's relationship with Hezbollah. What are they placing a staying hand on the moment on activities? How do you assess that?
I think they are, yes. So Iran doesn't control Hezbollah, but they do tend to act in concert. Iran provides them with a lot of hardware, military equipment, their most dangerous long-range weapons that scare Israel, things like the Fateh 110, the Yachont. These have got a range of about 300 kilometers. There's another one, the Zelzel 2, that can reach most cities in Israel. They've got enough of these, even after all these airstrikes that Israel is trying to degrade that arsenal. They've got enough of them that they could probably overwhelm Israel's air defences. But they haven't really used them yet, and probably the reason for that, almost certainly, Iran is not keen on Hezbollah using up its big, powerful missiles. Because, why? Because it wants that as a deterrent against Israel threatening Iran's own nuclear sites. If you remember, Israel and quite a few other countries and Western countries strongly suspect that Iran is up to no good with its nuclear program. Iran insists it's entirely peaceful, but it's been enriching uranium way beyond the needs, beyond the level you would need for peaceful nuclear energy. It's enriching it up to the level you can make a nuclear bomb. So there's a lot of suspicion there. And Iran, the theory is that Iran wants to keep Hezbollah with the kind of finger on the trigger, as it were, with this great big long-range arsenal of missiles cocked and ready as a deterrent to stop Israel trying to take out Iran's right. nuclear sites.
So when does, though, Frank, this piecemeal Israeli approach, then when does that tip over and suddenly Iran realises, or Hezbollah say, hang on, we've got to go all out here because we're being degraded too far? I mean, it's a margin, yeah, thing, isn't it?
It is. I mean, you know, when does a war become a full-scale war? I mean, you know, if you're caught in the middle of this in South Lebanon, or stuck in traffic on the road to Beirut, fleeing the conflict, it probably already feels like a full-scale war. How can it get much worse? Well, the answer is that Israel could still do more than that. It could, if Hezbollah starts hitting Israeli cities and killing a lot of civilians in the way that Israel has been doing to Lebanon, then I would expect Israel would retaliate catastrophically against Lebanon's infrastructure. So things like Beirut Airport would get hit, reservoirs, power stations, bridges, similar to what happened in 2006, where they fought a 34-day war that basically neither side won. Now, if Israel has to go in on the ground, I think they could quite possibly get a bit of a hammering again as they did in 2006. Their Israeli intelligence is better than it was back then, but nevertheless, don't underestimate Hezbollah. They've spent the last few years fighting in Syria in support of President Bashar al-Assad against Sunni Islamists, people like al-Qaeda and ISIS. So they are battle-hardened, and they've got a lot of training from the Iranians, a lot of up-to-date weaponry. They're very good at ambush tactics and things like concealed weapons, off-route mines, IEDs, improvised explosive devices. You know, and they will fight a classic guerrilla-style warfare. They know all those valleys, those orchards, those gullies that the Israelis would have to fight them in on their home turf. It won't be an easy fight. Israel's got the firepower, the satellite intelligence, the backing of the US, but Hezbollah's got the ideology, the fanaticism, and the training. So I don't think Israel's going to be in a hurry to go in on the ground. It's going to try and achieve its aims from the air. Personally, I'm not sure that's going to work. Hezbollah are going to want to be resilient. They're going to want to survive this. and they won't want to be pushed into a ceasefire deal that they feel shows weakness, because that weakens them, their standing within Lebanon. They will want something quite attractive to persuade them to move north of the Litani River and to stop lobbing rockets. And what they want is a ceasefire in Gaza, which is so far eluding everybody.
Frank, great as always to have you on the programme. Thank you very much. That's Frank Gardner, the BBC security correspondent. Well, joining us now is Jane Kinnemont, an expert on the Middle East at the European Leadership Network. Hello, Jane.
Hello, good evening.
Hiya. Frank was updating us then on the current issues in Lebanon. He also is, the first question I asked him was to explain the three-way relationship between Lebanon, Hezbollah and Israel. I want to just go into a little bit more detail on that with you, Jane, if I can. Can you explain the relationship between the people of Lebanon and Hezbollah, how the group managed to get a grip on the country, and how solid is that group? What is that relationship between Hezbollah and your ordinary Lebanese person on the street?
Well, it really depends which Lebanese person on the street you're going to ask. But Hezbollah is often described as a state within a state. It is a combination of a militia group with arms and a political party. It holds about 10% of seats in the Lebanese parliament. And it's one of the two main groups that represents the Shia Muslim community in Lebanon, which is a really diverse country, which also has large Sunni Muslim, Christian and Jews population. So it is an indigenous group from inside Lebanon. But because it has this close alliance with Iran, there are many critics of Hezbollah inside Lebanon who say that it is serving a foreign agenda and who feel that it's sort of dragging the country into a continued conflict with Israel that not everyone in Lebanon really buys into. I mean, the group rose up in the 1980s in response to Israel having invaded and occupied Lebanon at that time. You can go on and on about who started these conflicts in a way. But it's very hard now to see how the conflict between Israel, Hezbollah and Lebanon could be resolved without some larger grand bargain that involves Iran, and that is extremely complicated.
And what about Hezbollah as a group? Would it be impossible for other people in Lebanon to remove them? Are they there for the duration? For example, is there an open forum where they can be criticised by other people within Lebanon?
Well, they can be criticised, but the stickiest question is, could they be disarmed? Would there be a way to stop them acting as a state within a state that has, you know, independent power over the use of force and turn them into a more normal political party in the longer term? And the answer to that basically is no. There are UN resolutions that envisage that Hezbollah should be disarmed. Peacemakers would like to see it absorbed into the Lebanese National Army. But the Lebanese state and the national army simply are not strong enough to do that. So that is part of the problem here. And it does relate to the fact that it's part of this bigger regional conflict, that for Iran, Hezbollah is the number one of its foreign allies, the most important group that it has relations with. But Iran has always seen Hezbollah as a group that could help to defend Iran. And now it's facing a question of whether it, Iran, might want to come and find some way to defend Hezbollah. That's a role reversal, and that's not something that Iran was betting on.
No. And just a final question then, Jane. What do you feel Israel wants at this stage? Because we heard from Frank that about that ground invasion in 2006, which didn't end particularly well for Israel. And indeed, in the past few moments, the Israeli ambassador to the UN has said Israel is not eager for a ground invasion of Lebanon. So I guess you can, unless you know they're dissembling, you can rule that out in the immediate future. What do Israel want? I mean, they vow to destroy Hamas. What do they want to do with Hezbollah, do you think?
They have been much more pragmatic in the way that they are talking about this war. That doesn't necessarily mean that it will remain contained. But as you say, Israel pledged to destroy Hamas. They are not saying that about Hezbollah. The Israeli politicians have been saying that their aim is to be able to return Israeli citizens to the north of Israel without them being fearful of Hezbollah missiles. And meanwhile, Hezbollah has been saying that its aim is to secure a ceasefire in Gaza. So actually, neither of these aims is unachievable. You know, there should be something possible diplomatically, and yet it seems that the diplomats are helpless. We're really seeing this sight of everybody gathering in New York saying there must be restraint many, many thousands of miles away from the region while the violence on the ground increases.
Jane, good to have you on the show. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Jane Kinnemont there, expert on the Middle East at the European Leadership Network. So what useful there just to obviously update ourselves on latest news, but also just to try and place some context on the conflict as it stands at the moment. Right, 20 past six on Drive.
Yeah, really interesting to listen to that. And if you just tuned in late there, you can listen back to it on BBC Science because it's really important, I think, sometimes to set that out for people. Lots still to come before 7 o'clock. If you haven't heard of old dry Keith, let me tell you, that's going to change before 7 o'clock. If you don't know about Keith Brown, he's an internet sensation in China who has sadly died. He was famous for posting videos of boring sandwiches, basically, something Tony knows all about.
Yep, I'll have a lot to offer that interview later on. Thank you.
Very intrigued on that one. Before all that, though, let's get the latest from the cricket. What's going on in Chesterless Street? Ellie's there. It's a bit, I said earlier, it was a bit of a mountain to climb, but the ship is steadied, I think is the phrase, isn't it?
Absolutely. They've chipped away at that mountain really brilliantly, Will Jackson, Harry Brook. They put on 125 together so far. 136 for two is the score in the 24th over, and they've pretty much scored neck and neck. Will Jack's currently on 67. Harry Brook is on 57. They've just taken 19 off Mitchell Stark's last over, and when you think about it, you kind of think twice. Mitchell Stark, one of the most talented and well-established bowlers in this Australian lineup. I think they're missing Adam Zampa probably in this innings Australia at the moment. But 169 needed from 27 overs. I'm sitting alongside England World Cup winner, England Ashes winner. He did win the Ashes. He's nodding.
Get the full CV out here.
Currently injured, of course, at the moment, Mark Wood. In your home ground, in your home territory. We've been enjoying this partnership, haven't we?
Yes, you mentioned a mountain. It's more of a hill now. Feeling very positive. Yeah. So we're doing pretty well. I mean, I don't want to put the comedy as cursing them, but we're on the charge. And, both innings sort of mirror each other. It was difficult at the start for Australia when they were batting. It was difficult for England. And now we've managed to get this partnership. If you look at the Duckworth-Lewis score, of course, which if it rains, it's 1-2-6. We're 14 ahead of that already, which suggests we're ahead of the game. Of course, we all know how that changes if we lose wickets, but I'm feeling a lot more comfortable.
Yeah, you're looking a lot more comfortable as well than you were a little bit earlier on. We've talked about Duckworth-Lewis, and it will only come into force if it does rain here, and we've had a lovely day. But I mentioned to Tony and Holly earlier on that we've had the central heating on in the commentary box, and you were telling me something about the dressing rooms here at the Riverside Ground.
Yes, so, I mean, these are just the one percenters, but if you look across to the home dressing room, you'll see a nice red tinge and glaze on the home team, the England team. That's because they've got the heaters on. And if you look at the away team, absolutely no tinge whatsoever. There's no heaters on that side there, and the woolly hat's freezing, shivering, and that's how we do things up north.
This is this is a northeast welcome, Tony.
Mark Ellie would be the kind of person to put an anorak on if she went on the big market. That's all. That's and a vest. That's all I'm saying. I'll leave that there.
All full thermals, not just a vest.
Well, Mark, they're certainly looking after you there in the TMS team. Ellie said earlier they've never had the central heating on before. It's all starting to add up now. It was all for you. Never had you down for a day.
I don't need it. I don't want to be tarnished with that brush. From the northeast, I've got a reputation to keep up here. And heatings, I mean, I'm toasty. In fact, I'm a little bit too warm, Ellie, if I'm honest.
Yeah, he's not got his big coat on, Holly. We wanted to ask you, actually, about how you are currently, because, you played against the West Indies earlier in the season, and then a little bit of an injury, a little bit of a niggle, and all of a sudden it's turned into quite a big issue, and you're going to miss the Test matches during the winter, aren't you?
Yeah, bizarre injury. I'd managed to tweak my groin a little bit, and it was only going to be a week out, and while I was having that week off, we were going to get my elbow looked at, something I've had trouble with before, but it was only a bit of sort of stiffness and things. It wasn't anything too bad, but of course the scan comes back and it suggests a much bigger issue, a bone stress issue. No stress fracture at the minute, but I've got to go back and see the specialist at a very swanky Harley Street next week, and hopefully that is good news. And trying to stay positive with it, I'm going to be out till the new year. But yeah, a bit of a bizarre injury, just came out of nowhere really. So hopefully I can, you know, get back to form in early 2025.
So basically, at one point, you couldn't use your right arm for anything?
At all. No, I was just saying to you there, hopefully my left arm's going to be a bit like Rafael Nadal. In the end, I'm going to have this huge left arm and this tiny right arm. But yeah, I wasn't even allowed to pick my children up. That was the doctor's orders. My wife didn't seem to like them orders as much. But I said, look, for 2 weeks, it was for 3 weeks, but my wife, of course, didn't like that either. So we've bargained on 2 weeks and, you know, picked my kids up with my left arm, but, yeah, I wasn't allowed to pick them up with my right arm.
Were you not tempted to sort of throw a few other things in there? But, you know, the doctor says I can't do the dishes now for 3 weeks.
Yeah,
doctor's orders.
Absolutely. I tried everything and she wasn't buying anything. I had to get, like, written proof that it was definitely not just my right arm. So, yeah.
Doctor's note to get you out of doing
exactly,
the dishes.
Exactly.
Yeah. Look, it's going actually not too badly for England at the moment. So all the kind of negativity that we had when we went on air at Tony and Holly has diminished a little bit now. 142 for two, England in the 25th over, so 305 is the target, and they're pretty much halfway there. I'm not quite sure whether that means we'll get Bon Jovi played at the halfway point in the innings and the halfway point in the overs as well. But Harry Brook 57, Will Jack 73 have played very nicely indeed here, and they've given England a decent chance of keeping this series alive.
I'm changing my they've had it comment to they might have had it. That's just something's happened. What's just happened there?
Yeah, well, that was a four from Harry Brook. That was a kind of, actually, was it a ramp, a reverse ramp?
Like
it was kind
ramp,
of like
scoop shot,
ramp scoop thing, down to the boundary. Sean Abbott, you know, Australia have got very good bowlers, but they are short of one of their best in Adam Zampa, and they may well start to struggle for options at some point.
All right, well, for now, hopefully we'll speak to you before the end of the show, and I'm sure cricket fans won't be wanting Mark to get too comfortable in the commentary box.
No,
there, Mark.
No, we love having him in the commentary box.
Yes.
But we want him back out there on the field before too long.
Absolutely. Speak to you a little later, and of course there's full commentary over on 5 Live Sports Extra as well.
Yeah, let's keep up to date with that. Just to give you a heads up as well, you may have heard a trail earlier on. Rachel from 5 Live Breakfast has been interviewing the Prime Minister today after his speech to the Labour Party conference, so you can hear that on Breakfast tomorrow. Breakfast starts at 6 o'clock, so you'll hear that interview. Rachel meets the Prime Minister tomorrow on Breakfast, 26 minutes past six.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
We need somebody to look after our economy.
It's the biggest issue in Scotland at the moment.
Wherever you are in the UK, you're part of this with us on this network. 5 Live Drive.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
27 minutes past six, Holly and Tony here with you. And among the promises that you might have heard today made by the Prime Minister in his speech at the Labour Party conference in Liverpool was that a Hillsborough law would be introduced before the next anniversary of the Hillsborough disaster. Now, the legislation will introduce a legal duty of candour on all public bodies. And today, Sir Keir Starmer referred to a speech that he made in Liverpool 2 years ago.
Because that's when I promised, or on this stage, that if I ever had the privilege to serve our country as Prime Minister, one of my first acts would be to bring in a Hillsborough law, a duty of candour. A law for Liverpool, a law for the 97, a law that people shouldn't have had to fight so hard to get, that will be delivered by this Labour government. It's also a law for the sub-postmasters in the Horizon scandal, the victims of infected blood, Windrush, Grenfell Tower, and all the countless injustices over the years suffered by working people at the hands of those who were supposed to serve them. Truth and justice concealed behind the closed ranks of the state. And conference, this is the meaning of Clause 1. Because today I can confirm that the duty of candour will apply to public authorities and public servants, the bill will include criminal sanctions, and that the Hillsborough law will be introduced to Parliament before the next anniversary in April.
Well, with us now is Louise Brooks, a campaigner whose brother Andrew died in the Hillsborough tragedy. Good evening, Louise.
Good evening.
Louise, thanks for coming on. First of all, were you aware of this announcement by Sir Keir Starmer in his speech today?
No. So yesterday I received a text message from a journalist asking me what Keir's speech was going to be, what his announcement was going to be, and I just hadn't got a clue what this journalist was on about. So they tried to find out the information, and I contacted my solicitor, and he wasn't aware, so he contacted our inquest solicitors, and apparently they were aware of the announcement today. So myself and another seven families are really not very happy, to be honest with you. I think it's very disrespectful, you know, that other people have known and we were not made aware of this announcement. Usually what the protocol is that we usually receive official letters, you know, like from the IOPC, UpResolve, etc., saying there's going to be an announcement, and usually we get invited along, you know, like with the ICSI court. But we had none of this at all, and I think it's very, very disrespectful. You know, this is meant to be a law in the name of our loved ones, and we're finding out at the same time as the public, and I think it's disgraceful. But like I say, myself and another seven families are very, very unhappy about it.
So, yeah, in terms of how you find out the news, really angry. But what about the content? What about what he had to say?
Well, quite frankly, the duty of candour, I don't think it's worth the paper it's written on. There's already a law. It's called Perjury and Perverting the Course of Justice. What I was very disappointed in, one of the elements of the US law, which I do fully support, is the legal funding for legal representation. So having a level playing field, so to speak, where the victims bereaved get the same amount of funding, well, actual funding for legal representation. So going back to 1989, 1990, we bereaved families, we had no funding whatsoever. We had to fund and raise our own money to pay for our legal representation, where the likes of David Duckerfield and Bernard Murray, they didn't have to pay a single penny, and they had the best legal representation. We were outgunned. I mean, we had one barrister and they had about four or five, and this is where I am very, very eager for you know, that to be rectified.
In terms of, and just to pick up on what you were saying there about the, you know, the duty of candour, and you don't feel that that's gone far enough, because that's part of the argument, that the idea that the threat of jail, as this law would impose now, that hopefully would be enough to guarantee the survivors and the families of those victims, of whether that's Hillsborough or Grenfell, that would be enough to prevent cover-ups, to prevent, as Sir Keir Starmer called it, truth and justice being concealed.
But everybody's forgetting there are already two laws. One's called perjury, one's called perverting the course of justice. So if somebody withholds evidence, that's perverting the course of justice. If somebody doesn't tell the truth, that's perjury. And during the Hillsborough inquest in Warrington, you know, myself and Chrissy Burke, we had a little bit of a joke between us, and we used to call it the College of Cover-Ups, because we would watch police officer after police officer literally enter that witness box and blatantly lie. So they would say, they'd say, no, I wasn't there. They're a prime example. One police officer, he categorically stated he was not in the Hillsborough football ground. His duties were outside the football ground. He categorically said, I did not step one foot in that football ground. So Michael Mansfield showed him the video evidence, which showed him literally stood in front of Pen 3.
Yeah. How do you stop them? What do you think is the answer? If the threat of jail isn't enough, how do you prevent things like that happening?
Well, what I've always said, it all begins at the top, you know, like with your chief constables, with the establishment, with the government, because what the problem is, in my opinion, and why there's so much corruption and cover-up, is because they know they are protected by the establishment, by the organisations, you know, by their chief constables or the government, etc. And until those at the top are held accountable, nothing will ever change, you know. And this is my issue. And, you know, you shouldn't have to have a law for people to tell the truth. And my other opinion is that if somebody does not want to tell the truth, or it's not in their vested interest to tell the truth because they know they are going to be protected, they will not. And the way they get away with it is they'll say, I don't recall, I don't recollect, which is how the joke began between myself and Christy Burke about them attending this college of cover-up. Because they all get trained. They get trained by their barristers what to say and what not to say. And how can you prove whether somebody does or does not remember anything? And this is how they all get away with it.
Yeah.
Because they don't, well, I don't recall. I mean, I used to watch the post office inquiry. And do you know what? When I was watching certain witnesses going in that witness box, I literally felt like I was back sitting in Ariel's Brinquest. Because it literally was written from the same script. I don't recall, I don't recollect. Then you get the crocodile tears. Then they're all remorseful. But they're not remorseful. All they care about, what they're crying over, is they're scared that they've actually been caught out. But I feel that we've got to do something. But I don't think the duty of candour is practical. And, you know, time will tell. I mean, I'm more interested in the legal funding. I think that is so important.
Yeah.
But I think that it's all down to a person's moral fibre. They know when they're doing right from wrong, you know. It's all about greed. It's all about money.
Look, Louise, we really appreciate you sharing your reaction with us today and appreciate what you're saying. Louise Brooks, who is a campaigner whose brother Andrew died in the Hillsborough tragedy, reacting to Sir Keir Starmer, confirming the Hillsborough law will be introduced in Parliament before the next anniversary of the 1989 football stadium tragedy. Slightly out of time, it's 6:37. Let's get your BBC News headlines.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Yes, the headlines on Drive tonight then. Sir Keir Starmer has said things will be tough for the short term, but it will be worth it in the long term during his speech to the Labour Party conference in Liverpool. The Prime Minister has said he'll lead a great reforming government that will improve the economy, tackle welfare fraud and reduce energy bills. President Biden has told the UN General Assembly that a diplomatic solution to the conflict in the Middle East is still possible despite intense strikes between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon. Israel says it's killed one of the militant group's senior commanders with an airstrike on the Lebanese capital, Beirut. We'll get the latest from the UN General Assembly very shortly on that. Two men aged 52 and 18 have been arrested on suspicion of murder after a 15-year-old boy was stabbed to death in southeast London. The Metropolitan Police have named the boy who died in Woolwich as Dejuan Campbell. And the number of people in Scotland living in temporary accommodation because of homelessness has reached a record high. As of March this year, more than 16,000 people were in the system, according to Scottish Government figures released today. That's a 9% increase on the year before. Right, that is the news. Jonathan McKean's here with the sport.
Tony, thank you. After an initial wobble, England's cricketers are now motoring along in their reply to Australia's 304-7 in their third one-day international in Durham. With the latest is Ellie Aldridge.
And there are 166 for two in the 28th over. They've put on 150 runs together, Will Jacks and Harry Brooks, since at that point when Ben Duckett was out, and England were 11 for two and looking in all sorts of trouble, pursuing that target of 305 to beat Australia and keep this series alive. And they've played shots all around the ground, but they've done it patiently at the start and then gone through the different gears. But that is a wicket now. Cameron Green, Will Jacks just having a bit of a swipe at one and down to the boundary and caught. So he is out and that partnership is over. But it has put England in a strong position, but they are going to have to rebuild again. But Will Jacks out for 84 of 82 balls. And England, well, it's going to be fascinatingly poised this game at this point. 166 for three now, chasing 305 to win.
Ellie, thank you. Yeah, it should be a really good watch. Commentary continues on Five Sports Extra. Big night of EFL Cup action to look forward to, though. On Five Live, we'll start at Adams Park. League One, Wycombe Wanderers at home to Premier League Aston Villa. Already in place is our commentator for this one, Alistair Bruce Ball.
Yes, Wycombe welcome Premier League opposition to Adams Park for the first time in just under 4 years tonight, since Jose Mourinho brought his Tottenham team to town in the FA Cup and Gareth Bale scored one of the goals in a 4-1 win for them. So tonight, it's an in-form Aston Villa team with a very in-form striker in John Duran, who'll be itching to prove his point again as he tries to break into their starting lineup on a regular basis. But Wycombe are in good form too, winning five of their last six games. They're an attacking team, and the manager Matt Bloomfield knows all about the cup upsets as part of that Wycombe team that reached the semi-finals of this competition back in 2007, knocking Premier League sides Fulham and Charlton out along the way.
Full commentary with Ali in Five Live Sport from 8 o'clock. After the cricket, Five Sports Extra will bring you all the action from Leicester City's trip to Walsall. Lee Blakeman will be watching this one.
And Leicester could do with this being as routine as possible tonight, Jonathan, with a number of fans booing at the end of Saturday's 1-1 draw with Everton. It was because it was their fifth Premier League game out of five without a win, although three of those have been draws. And then Leicester have the prospect of Arsenal away on Saturday. They breeze past another League Two side in Tranmere in the last round of this competition, and they'll be hoping to do the same thing tonight. But they're up against a Walsall team who've won five of their opening seven, all of their last three in all competitions, and sit third in the League Two table as a result.
To West London, where Chelsea are at home to League Two leaders Barrow at Stamford Bridge, is John Southall.
Yes, good evening from the Bridge. Big night this for Barrow, and they're near on 3,000 fans who've made the 600-mile round trip for their second ever meeting with Chelsea. 64 places separate these two, Chelsea fifth in the Premier League and Barrow top of League Two. Five wins from their opening seven games. They've had a really good start to the season. They, you hope, will be at full strength tonight. Chelsea, I suspect, will change pretty much the whole 11, give or take maybe one or two from the win at West Ham. It's a tall order for Barrow, there's no doubt about that, but it should be a good night in West London.
John, thank you. Updates too of Manchester City against Watford. And Joe El Abd, currently the head coach of French rugby side Oyonnax, is close to agreeing a deal to become England men's new defence coach. That's the latest from BBC Sport. You can listen on your smart speaker by saying play BBC Sports News.
And your final look at your travel tonight. So the M11, there's a big queue showing. It's on the southbound side, 9 to 8. Saffron Walden down to Bishop Stortford. A vehicle's caught fire, so everything at a stand. The M8 in Glasgow, Junction 13 near the M80 at Provan. Two lanes still closed for the repairs going on there. And the M1 in West Yorkshire, looking slowed on the southbound side, 40 at Ossett to 39 at Wakefield. The accident's been moved off the road, but the queues are still there. The M25, it's looking heavy anti-clockwise. Junction 12 at the M3, backing up to 13 at Staines. More repairs going on. M3 heading south at Basingstoke at Junction 6, one lane down there. The A55 North Wales Expressway. And between Junction 34 at Ewlow and 33B at Mould, it looks as though there's a full road closure in, and the queues are backing up to Junction 35 at Dobbs Hill. That's on the westbound side. The A494 is backing up to the Shottick area as well. And Tower Bridge in London is still closed in both directions because of an accident. I just need to warn you about the trains. Quite a bit of disruption. It's worth checking ahead, but the West Coast main line in particular, so between Stoke and Macclesfield, because of an incident at Macclesfield, it looks as though there are problems there. Also cross country and GWR between Reading and Didcot Parkway, and then we've also had a few problems elsewhere with branch lines because of residual flooding. Orna Merchant, Five Live Travel.
Five Live Breakfast.
This week, the Labour Party conference is underway in Liverpool. I've been speaking to the Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer, following his speech to his party's members. You can hear the full interview tomorrow on Five Live Breakfast.
Five Live Breakfast. Listen weekdays from 6 on BBC Sounds.
The voice of the UK.
This is Five Live Drive.
6:43 on Drive. Joe Biden's told world leaders there's still time to contain the growing military conflict in the Middle East. The violence between Israel and Hezbollah has overshadowed the opening session of the United Nations General Assembly. World leaders have been warning against an escalation, with the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres saying the situation with Lebanon was on the brink of becoming another Gaza. President Biden's been delivering his final speech to the UN as American leader.
Full-scale war is not in anyone's interest. Even if the situation has escalated, a diplomatic solution is still possible. In fact, it remains the only path to lasting security to allow the residents from both countries to return to their homes and the border safely. And that's what we're working tirelessly to achieve.
Well, let's speak to our correspondent Neda Torfik, who joins us now. Hi, welcome to the show. He talked of hope there. What realistic hope did he offer, Neda, apart from words, do we think? Were there any solutions on the horizon today?
Well, certainly members in the hall, press following this speech, Joe Biden's final speech to this annual gathering of the UN General Assembly, were looking for perhaps any new specifics, new ideas, given, as you say, the latest escalation in Lebanon has really overshadowed the General Assembly meeting here. But Joe Biden instead really stuck to the U.S.'s longstanding positions, again urging Israel and Hamas to finalize a ceasefire hostage deal, a deal that the administration hasn't been able to get now for the past several months, despite saying that they were close to one many times, and despite kind of the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken traveling to the region time and time again. But President Biden tried to still strike this note of optimism, saying that he is, an elder statesman that has worked at times of great change and different inflection points over the last several decades, and saying that he still thinks a diplomatic solution is possible, that his administration is working tirelessly to get one. It's interesting because his tone and his speech has really been far different from others that we've heard from. You mentioned the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres saying that the world can't afford for Lebanon to become another Gaza. But we also heard from, for example, the King of Jordan, King Abdullah, and also Turkey's president, both of them really warning that Western values and the UN system itself was being eroded by what's happening in Gaza.
Yeah, and I guess, Neda, as well, not just Gaza and Lebanon, but also Ukraine would have been high on the agenda as well today.
Absolutely. While Joe Biden was speaking, you had the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky listening closely to what he had to say. He, of course, is coming with what he calls his victory plan to present to President Biden, also to leaders in the U.S. Senate later, and also former President Trump. He's hoping to speak with him and Kamala Harris about his plan. And this is also just part of some of the engagements he has at the United Nations, because later this afternoon, there's going to be a Security Council meeting on Ukraine, where the president of Ukraine will be speaking to the body, to other leaders there. For him, he still feels it's important for Ukraine to project strength, to show it can go on the military offensive, to force Russia to the negotiating table. But if you speak to UN officials, they are under no illusions that peace in Ukraine is imminent. They still feel as though both parties are determined at the moment to fight it out. So between what we see in the Middle East and Ukraine, a feeling here at the United Nations that peace isn't really on the horizon for either conflict.
Neda, thank you. Neda Torfik there at the UN. Well, Natasha Lindstedt joins us, Professor of Government at the University of Essex. Natasha, hi to you. Just on the subject of Biden himself, I guess we're at the point now where, you know, his motives will be honourable, I suppose, in the sense he's trying to solve these problems, but he'll also have one eye on his legacy, knowing that he's about to step down.
Right. I mean, it's incredibly important to his legacy that he was able to make some kind of inroads here. I know that his administration has been working around the clock to establish some kind of ceasefire, but I see this as incredibly unlikely to happen. And they've been so close so many different times, but at various times there has been an increasing demand from Israel, whether it to be that they wanted to maintain their own soldiers along the Philadelphia corridor. That was something that wasn't stipulated in one of the beginning of their negotiation for the ceasefire. which would have been this demilitarized zone along the Egyptian border, or different stipulations about the timing of Palestinian prisoners exchange for hostages. So at the different points where they were almost at a deal, something happened that thwarted it. And I think this is incredibly frustrating to the Biden administration at the moment.
What does this say about the relationship between Biden and Netanyahu? Because there was a perception right at the start of this crisis that Biden held the whip hand, but it obviously, from what you've just said, it would seem not.
Yeah, I have never seen the relationship between the U.S. and Israel as one where the U.S. is telling Israel what to do. Israel has tremendous capacity, all kinds of military power to even take on wars on two fronts in both Gaza and Lebanon. And though there is, you know, a tremendous amount of military aid that Israel is a recipient of from the U.S., at this point, under Netanyahu's government, that's become increasingly right-wing, particularly the influence of two cabinet members that are influencing Netanyahu. They're taking advantage of this moment to do whatever they want to do. I mean, the recent pager attack, this is something like you couldn't even think of. Of the very brazen killing of Haniyeh, who was the pragmatist, Ismail Haniyeh, the pragmatist political leader of Hamas, who was key to the negotiations. I mean, things have been taking place that would be going completely against a ceasefire, which is in U.S. interest, which is frustrating to the U.S. at the moment.
Right. So just to end then, why are the U.S. so seemingly powerless then?
Because Israel can do whatever it wants to do, and there's very little that the U.S. could do about it, particularly right now with the election. I think Netanyahu would prefer that there would be no ceasefire until Trump is elected, because if Trump is elected, then he'll have free rein to do what he needs to do to tackle Iran.
Natasha, we have to leave it there. Thanks for your time. Natasha Linstead, the Professor of Government at the University of Essex. It's 10 to 7.
All right, we've got time to drop in again with Ellie Aldroyd. Ellie, oh, Will Jacks. Oh,
I know.
So unlucky. Yeah, so unlucky. Missing out in the 100.
Well, I know, Jess, he played so brilliantly and so well in combination with Harry Brook as well. So Jack's out for 84 off 82 balls. That partnership, 156 between him and Harry Brook. But England's acting captain is still there. He's 76 off 73 balls. And Jamie Smith, who's been one of the big success stories for England this season, is at the other end. But they just want to keep this run rate ticking over now. 180 for three. The target is 305, and we're just coming to the end of the 30th over. So this is a really crucial stage. At the moment, they are ahead of the Duckworth-Lewis Stern figure, which is 164 currently, and they're 180 for three. So if it were to start raining now, England, and that we could get any more play, and then England would win the game on DLS. And we're hoping that won't come into consideration. There is a beautiful sunset here over the Riverside ground. But we will see what happens. I think this is a slightly nail-biting moment, perhaps, for England cricket fans as England try and get back into this series and actually inflict the first defeat on Australia in an ODI in 14 games. So it would be quite remarkable if they can do this, particularly having thought at one stage that they were right up against it at 11 for 2. But 181 for 3, coming to the end of the 30th over with Smith on 5 and Brook on 77.
There's still time for them to blow it, Ellie. However,
there's time for them to win it, Tony.
There is.
There is time for them to blow it, depending on your glass. The level in your glass.
I haven't even got a glass, Ellie.
No.
I'll listen on my way home. However, just a very quick one from me. The TV's just zeroed in on the scoreboard, and you made the point that they know they're above the Duckworth-Lewis run rate. Has that always been the case, that batting sides knew? Because I thought back in the very early days of Duckworth-Lewis, it was you didn't know till afterwards. But they've always known, have they?
Well, I mean, do you know, I think that's a very good question, Tony. I don't know the answer to that, basically. Okay. But I remember in the days when it was DL and no S, so Duckworth-Lewis without Stern, that they'd give you a sheet and you had to sort of do the calculations yourself. It was a bit like having a slide rule that you had to kind of check and see where you were up to. But yes, I mean, basically, people who don't know what we're talking about, it's the kind of the point in the game that they are at with the number of runs they've got on the board and the number of wickets that they've lost as well. So if England were to lose another wicket now, they're currently 182 for three, but if it was 182 for four, then that DLS number would rise proportionally because it would give Australia a bit of an advantage that they don't currently have. But a wicket falling will make that difference.
Ellie, thank you. From Ellie to Kelly. Kelly Cates is here with Five Live Sport at 7. Hello, Kelly.
Hello, good evening to you. Yes, there's plenty in the balance for us as well in the EFL Cup third round this evening. We've got potential giant killings on our hands. Wickham, who in 2007 got to the semi-finals, they're at home to Aston Villa. And, you know, we've already heard from Unai Emery that Villa are going to be much changed. The problem is that much changed might well mean that John Duran, who's been a real super sub for Villa this season, gets a start in this one. So, you know, lots of changes doesn't necessarily mean a weak team for Aston Villa. Similarly for Man City, they're at home to Watford. Chelsea are at home to Barrow. And it's Walsall against Leicester. And we're going to keep you across everything with commentary of that game between Wickham and Villa.
Beautiful. Kelly, we'll always have Paris. I'm currently drinking the hot chocolate that you recommended.
A little walk along the Seine.
Yeah, I'm drinking the hot chocolate you recommend. I went back and bought some. It's lovely.
Good, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, very good, very good. Right, I'll catch up with you later. See you later. Bye-bye.
That's 2 days in a row you've brought up Paris.
Well,
every day.
It's okay. You know, if you were there, you were there. That's all I'll say. Look, Laura's through the window. She was there with me.
You were all at Paris.
Mon ami. Right, quick. 6:54.
BBC Radio 5 Live. The voice of the UK.
On digital radio.
On BBC Sounds.
And ask your smart speaker
to play BBC Radio 5 Live.
5 Live Drive. Listen on BBC Sounds.
Now, some of you might have heard of Old Dry Keith. If you haven't, he was sort of an unlikely online celebrity, I suppose. His real name was Keith Brown. He became famous for videos that his wife posted on the social media platform Douyin, the Chinese version of TikTok. And basically, it was kind of just him making sandwiches. And those videos racked up millions of views online. Have a listen to this.
I make my lunch with a hammer. Hammer and tomato.
No tomato.
Tomato.
You do your hammer tomato sandwich. Hammer tomato sandwich.
Who knew a ham and tomato sandwich could be so interesting? Let's find out from the Times China correspondent, Richard Spencer. Oh, Richard, I think we just need to kind of spell this out. What made old dry Keith so popular, making bland old British sandwiches?
Yeah, it's quite a complex one, but also quite simple. Keith Brown, he married for a second time. He met a Chinese woman in Malaysia when he was working there as a petroleum engineer, and he eventually retired back to England with his wife and teenage son. And the wife was from a lady called Jiang Jian. She's from northeast China. She'd not lived in Britain before. And she started posting, the equivalent of TikTok videos about, you know, coming to terms with life in England. And, you know, it's quite a strange place if you're from northeast China, in the same way that if you're from northwest England, you might find China quite a strange place at first. But what really took off, as you say, were the videos of her husband making sandwiches, which is not a really Chinese thing to do. In a few, you know, westernized cities, you will see people eating sandwiches, but even in those cities, other Western foods are somewhat more popular than a ham and tomato sandwich. And it just became an object of fascination for, as you say, millions of Chinese who watched him make sandwiches, and they're very positive about dry food. They you know, Chinese eat stir fry and noodle soup, as we know, and dishes like that. They're not really into sort of dry food.
Yeah, we sort of have quite boring tastes, really, don't we? But actually, he made a bit of an impact because there are now actually dry sections in supermarkets. That's not because of Keith, is it?
Yeah, well, that's sort of a joke. I should say, before we get too jovial, the reason that he's in the news at the moment is he actually died, poor old Keith, of cancer quite recently. And so there's been a sort of bit of an outpouring of grief for him on the sort of Chinese internet, on Douyin, as you say, the Chinese TikTok. So it is a slightly sad story. But they called him Old Dry or Old Dry Keith, the internet users who commented on his videos, which is a kind of it's hard to explain, but it's a kind of Chinese, it's a reference to Chinese way of talking about older people with respect. There was this old dry as a sort of joke about supermarkets that have sort of wet food sections and dry food sections. I mean, we all know the idea of a wet food market from the COVID crisis. That phrase became very common. But so supermarkets will have a wet food section where you can buy your live fish or your chicken, and then they have a dry food section where you buy your rice and it's this sort of took off as an internet meme.
It's sort of a form of introspection. Look, I'll finish by you wrote an article and you quoted a Chinese writer. We go from questioning the dry old man to understanding the dry old man to becoming the dry old man. The old man is us, and his dry lunch is our dry life. It's the sandwich that holds everything together. I think that sums it up perfectly. The Times China correspondent, Richard Spencer, thank you so much for your time on that. What's on the menu tonight then?
I have the same sandwich four nights running, Monday to Thursday. I've just remembered I was going to ask everyone who's having the most boring tea tonight, but I think I've won anyway.
I think no matter what, you've won that one. Remind us what it is. What was it? Tuna and salad dressing?
Salad cream, brown bread.
That's it.
Right. Anyway, on that exciting note, Kelly Cates is here with 5 Live Sport. We will see you tomorrow at 4.
Have a lovely evening. See you then.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at 7 o'clock. This is Adam Porter. Sir Keir Starmer has pledged national renewal in his first speech to a Labour Party conference as Prime Minister. He promised to rebuild public services and protect working people and said he was prepared to take tough long-term decisions to do so. Addressing concerns his government had been too gloomy since taking office, he said there was light at the end of the tunnel. The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, said it had been right to inform the public about the difficulties the country faced.
I think it was absolutely right to spend time spelling out in terms the challenge we've inherited, whether it's the £22 billion black hole in the public finances or the shocking state of the NHS, yes, diagnosed very accurately by Lord Darzi. So that was important. But of course, this is a government that's about the future, not the past. And I think that came across very strongly in the Prime Minister's speech today.
President Biden has insisted a diplomatic solution can be found to avoid an all-out war in Lebanon. He was speaking at the UN General Assembly as Israel claimed to have killed a leading Hezbollah commander in an airstrike in Beirut. Two men have been arrested in connection with the murder of a 15-year-old boy in southeast London. Dehuan Campbell was discovered with fatal stab wounds in Woolwich on Sunday. A former police officer who admitted defrauding millions of pounds from investors in his horse racing syndicate has been jailed for 6 years. Maidstone Crown Court heard that Michael Stanley, an ex-sergeant with Kent Police, misused the money invested by around 6,000 members into the Lay Easy Racing Syndicate. Terry Wildey was one of the victims of the scam.
If you add up everything that across the whole family, we've put in close to £200,000. He's a rat, isn't he? I mean, you know, the whole thing, he set that up. He consciously set that up with the sole intention of taking people's money.
Police in Switzerland have arrested several people in connection with the use of a suicide device. Assisted suicide is legal in Switzerland, but is strictly regulated and requires...